Welcome to Case in Point, produced by the University of Pennsylvania Carey Law School. My name is Matt Marin, and I'm the Multimedia Coordinator from the Communications Department. And with me today is Michael Murphy, who is the Clinical Supervisor and Lecturer in the Law School's Entrepreneurship Legal Clinic. He joins us on Case in Point to discuss his article, The Search for Clarity in Attorney's Duty to Google. All right. So, Mike, thank you very much for joining us today on Case in Point. If you could start and talk a little bit about what is the duty to Google.
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here. And to answer your question, we're not sure. And that's what made this article so fun to research and to write, and why I hope it sort of creates a conversation that that is fun too. And as to sort of start to describe what it might be, I think it's best for me to talk about how I got involved with it. And it was because I was working on a prior article, and as I did, I found a couple of different cases in which judges were reprimanding attorneys for failing to use the internet in searching for facts about a matter. And when they did, they said, yeah, this attorney violated a duty to Google that all attorneys have. And I saw those cases and thought, that's not a thing, right? That doesn't actually exist. I have looked at the rules that exist that sort of regulate attorney behavior, and I never saw anything specifically about Google. And so that was sort of the genesis of this. And as I looked at those cases, I realized, yeah, right, like there is a sense out there that attorneys should be using an internet search. I used Google because it's sort of ubiquitous, right? Like kind of like Kleenex or Jell-O or Xerox. But there's a sense that attorneys should be using an internet search to conduct a factual investigation about their matter, but not just their matter, right? Not just like, what is this case about, but also like about their client, right? Also, if they're in litigation, about jurors. And also if they're about a transaction, about the parties in the transaction. And so I started to think, well, that's really interesting. I mean, we knew there were some rules out there that said that attorneys should be doing some kind of investigation to find the context of their matter and to make sure that the information they're receiving is true. And the information that they're arguing in court is true, and the arguments that they're arguing in court are true, or at least grounded in truth. But boy, I think there is nothing in there that says that you have to use this technology or that technology. And so that was where I started to realize that there might be this sense, but there isn't a rule, and that was obviously an issue. So the next step after that, right, was, okay, well, where might something like a rule exist? And so I started looking at how these attorneys are getting in trouble. Some of them were getting in trouble because of malpractice suits. So there's sort of malpractice law tells lawyers that they need to do things a certain way. Some of them were getting in trouble because of what we call ineffective assistance of counsel. That's where on an appeal from a criminal verdict, right, the defendant argues that their attorney at the trial level was ineffective one way or the other, right? And here it would be because that attorney didn't Google the particular facts or statements or whatever around a criminal case. But then sometimes, right, we see where attorneys are getting in trouble because they're violating what we call sort of rules of professional conduct, right? Each state requires attorneys who practice in that state to follow a rule of professional conduct, which says things like, don't steal from your clients, tell the truth in court, that sorts of stuff. Those rules come from a template. That template's called the Model Rules of Professional Conduct, which is released by the American Bar Association. And those Model Rules of Professional Conduct do have a couple different rules that, when you read them together, will kind of sort of tell attorneys that they should be Googling, right? One says that attorneys have to make an inquiry into the analysis of the factual and legal methods of whatever problems that they are looking at. It's not really in a rule, right? It's in what we call sort of a comment to the rule, which is like a footnote to the rule. And in that comment to the rule, it says attorneys need to be using technology proficiently, and whatever technology affects their practice, the attorneys need to know it, right? What's interesting about that, of course, is that that rule's usually only been interpreted to require attorneys to make sure that their emails are secure and things like that so that they don't have data breaches. It hasn't really been interpreted in this sense of attorneys need to be using technology for searches. So that was where I started to realize, huh, there is a duty here for attorneys to use the internet to search for certain facts about a matter. We're not sure exactly what yet, but we don't know where the duty's coming from. And my biggest concern was that attorneys were finding out they violated this duty because they didn't use the right technology or enough of it after they violated it, right? Which I was seeing was sort of the attorney's point of view here was I know I'm in trouble, but I don't know why, right? Because all I know is that I missed something. I could have done something else to not miss it, but there really wasn't any requirement that I use this technology, which would have found it. And so that was the genesis of the paper, was trying to figure out some sort of path forward so that these cases stop happening.
So what are the patterns you observed in why attorneys are failing to do proper research through online resources? Is it a matter of digital literacy, or are there other issues at play?
I'll take your easy either or question and tell you both. Yeah, absolutely. First of all, absolutely. There were digital literacy issues, and I think in a fair amount of them, right? These cases started with instances in which an attorney had a duty to locate someone, right? Like locate a missing party in a lawsuit, something of that nature, and they just weren't using the internet to find the person. They were like using the phone book, basically. And their argument was that they didn't know how to use the internet, and judges did not like that. And so that was years ago. Now, right, it's more along the lines of attorneys are saying, well, you know, we're concerned about privacy. We're concerned about proficiency, right? We're trying to find information about a juror whose name is John Smith, and it's a little tough to do on Google. How do we sort of parse that information? And so when we say sort of literacy and proficiency, like it's easy to think of just like an attorney who's just really bad at computers, which is like a stereotype for the industry. But what I argue in the paper is, while that is definitely true and it's definitely important to address that issue, there's more to it than that, right? Like there, in some senses, really satisfying this duty requires a significant level of proficiency. And one that is a bit beyond what you might expect an attorney to have. So that's just that. But then also, I think, you know, some of it is attorneys not thinking they have to, right? Remember, most attorneys still bill by the hour. Attorneys are expensive. There is ever a pressure to keep bills low and ever a pressure to be more efficient. And so attorneys are saying, look, like I can do a quick Google search of my client, but I don't really want to do, you know, 15 hours of Google research just to make sure that this matter is what I think it is. That's not efficient. I can't really bill for it. If I bill for it, I'm costing too much. And oh, by the way, you know, statistically, right, like 98% of Google searches never make it to the second page anyway, right? So there's luck involved too, right? If you're just using a little bit of time to search, you're relying on the algorithm providing you what you're looking for, right? And that's, I know we increasingly in this technological society are putting our faith in algorithms. And this is just another instance in which if the algorithm, you know, does not shine upon you that day, then you might also be in trouble and violate this duty without really knowing that.
So considering we have online resources and search engines to do some of this research, how does this new technology kind of compare to the way that things were done in the past? Because it seems like it's very salient to be able to pull up certain personal facts about a case as we're discussing.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I was able to find a parallel to this looking in the factual investigation area with the legal research area, right? Because there has been tremendous technological innovation over the last, say, 20, 30 years in legal research with the advent of Lexis and Westlaw and all these tools that allow attorneys to research cases electronically and to shepherdize cases electronically. And instead of like going and sort of a choose your own adventure series of books where you're hoping to find the right precedent and make arguments in briefs or evaluate legal issues, you can do that much easily through through electronic sources. And so similarly, what's happening, right, is that you're able to get this immense amount of information very quickly, which is great in some sense. But what it does is it sort of changes the skills that you need to be able to actually translate that information into something that allows you to use your professional judgment to move forward. In other words, like in the past, you might not be able to verify information about your clients or about arguments quite as easily. And so you didn't necessarily need to sort of flex those muscles in terms of evaluating a bunch of different information, some of which might be conflicting. Now you do, right? Now, just like anybody who logs onto social media to try to see what's going on in the world, lawyers really have to be source evaluators and information evaluators, right? Not just technologically literate, but able to take in information, process it, and make professional judgments about that information, about whether or not it's something that they should allow to shape their approach to a matter or to an argument.
Well, it kind of also sounds like it forces more transparency maybe on the process too, because you're not necessarily hiding behind the letter of the law. You actually have to have a more holistic approach to each individual case.
Yeah, I totally agree. Absolutely. You know, the other thing that makes it really, you're absolutely right. Like the other thing that makes it really interesting is it allows every attorney, even attorneys with fairly limited resources, to gain an awful lot of context about a matter and about what their arguments are. I think it can only be helpful as long as we're careful when we're fashioning the lines that we put in front of attorneys to say, listen, you have to do this and you don't have to do beyond that. It's nice if you do, of course, but like this is your standard of care, right? We still have to be careful about that because I think the question that I ask in the article that I try my best to answer, but I think is still out there is, you know, how much Googling is enough, right? Like every case is different. Every matter is different. There are so many other factors that shape what might be a reasonable amount of search with respect to one aspect of a case. And that's not even talking about what aspects do we search, right? Do we search the client's name, the client's address? And do we search every fact in the complaint or just the other ones? And then also as time goes on, are we continuing to search, right? Cases can last years. Should we be searching every 3 months, 6 months? And I think that answers are always different depending on the case. And ultimately, where we have to get here is that attorneys need to find some sort of reasonable and defensible path forward. And writing a rule for that is really tricky.
So how can the duty to Google be codified into legal practice? Do you see any potential challenges to codifying the duty?
Yeah, well, sorry. I mean, I think codifying the duty to Google is an absolute challenge, right? And I talk about that a little bit in the article when I start to look at where it might live if we were to have one, or maybe it lives in one more than one place, right? Is it a malpractice rule, right? Or is it part of that standard, or is it a rule of civil procedure, right? That we apply just for lawsuits. That is something that lawyers have to do when they're defending or prosecuting a lawsuit, or is it a rule of professional conduct such that it sort of applies in every scenario? And I settled on a rule of professional conduct mainly because that seemed to make the most sense, and that's where something similar to this rule already exists. But even then, right, I sketch out what I think the rule might be, but I completely understand that sort of as soon as you write it, it becomes obsolete, just kind of like any way in which you try to regulate technology. The technology is moving faster than the regulation. It always is. And so when you're trying to write down this rule, you have to try to make it flexible without being vague. And that is no easy task. I think that you can come up with a rule, but I think that you have to make sure that the purpose of the rule is, like I was saying, just that there's a reasonable and defensible argument that the attorney can make. And I would suggest that there's a little bit of a deference to the attorney's professional judgment. In other words, what I've saw in a lot of these cases was that the judges were being sort of backward looking, right? They found that the attorney had made a mistake and had assumed that the attorney did something wrong because the mistake had happened, right? In other words, there was this fact that existed that the attorney didn't find, so obviously they screwed up, right? Whereas I feel like we might want to look at these cases a little bit differently and say, well, you know, what resources did the attorney have at the time? What did the attorney do with those resources? Was the decisions that the attorney made at that point in their professional judgment reasonable? And if then, right, we find that the attorney's decisions were not great, then okay, maybe there is a sanction we should give the attorney. But if we look at that decision through the lens of the resources available at the time or that are reasonable, and we realize, wow, like we know this fact now, this fact is pretty apparent now, but it would have been really hard to find or impossible to find then I would give the attorney a break. That requires a lot trickier of an analysis and a lot more formal of an analysis. Which is where I think that even though it would be very difficult to codify a rule like this, I think it's a worthwhile enterprise.
Great. And whether it is a lapse of professional conduct or an honest mistake, what are the consequences for clients when their counsel doesn't use search engines or the World Wide Web for a given case?
I mean, I think it runs the entire spectrum from being, you know, fairly benign to slightly annoying to sort of incredibly catastrophic, right? For example, if you are in a trial and you don't research jurors and you find out that one of the jurors was biased in some way against your client, that might not have an effect on the verdict at all, right? People can overcome biases particularly if they're being instructed to be an impartial juror and they take that seriously. Good for them. Right. If you are in a same case and there's a witness who's very obviously lying, if you looked at their public social media profile and you don't do that, that could very conceivably have a much stronger impact. Right. That was an avenue of cross-examination that you just have failed to pursue because you didn't have that information, even though you could have fairly easily found it if you had taken the extra time to search that down. And keeping in mind, of course, right, like if you're, you know, for super huge law firms with tons of resources and the ability to scale up can very obviously track down social media profiles for every witness, even monitor them. Whereas like, you know, solo practitioners, legal aid associations, things like that, much tougher for them to do it. But it could also be completely catastrophic. And there's a couple of cases in the article where we discuss that. One is a transactional case, and which is near and dear to my heart. And it is a case out of Iowa where an attorney learned from a client that the client was going to inherit a large sum of money from a long-lost relative in Nigeria, which would be released once that client paid an outstanding tax debt to the Nigerian government. And so the attorney agreed to represent this client for a 10% commission. By the way, those of you listening to the podcast right now are probably already like shaking your heads and yelling on your jogs that this is an obvious scam. Undeterred, the attorney reached out to other clients and arranged for those clients to lend him money to pay the Nigerian tax debt, and then sent out that money to Nigeria, where it disappeared, never to be seen again. And so in that case, right, the disciplinary board in Iowa found that this was a very obvious scam, the Nigerian prince scam, which is based on the Spanish prisoner scam, for those of you who are into the history of scams. And if the attorney had just Googled the basic facts of this transaction, they would have received thousands of hits that this is a scam that is attempted, you know, thousands of times a day in emails that end up in your junk folder. It's an extreme example, right? And extreme examples, of course, make for good copy. They make for good case law cases, and they make for good article fodder. But it can happen, right? So that was obviously a hugely catastrophic result. Not necessarily for the original client. The original client got a great result because they were able to cheat a bunch of people out of a lot of money and not get caught. But it was a catastrophic result for the other clients, right? Like, and obviously for this lawyer whose reputation will more than likely never recover. And so that can be really, really bad. So that is an extreme example of how this can sort of go horribly wrong. And that's the degree. And again, right, like the real danger here is that in most of those cases, the hypotheticals in the real case, the attorney didn't realize they were doing something wrong until much later when the consequences came around.
That's wild. So how will the duty to Google change legal practice in the future?
Oh, boy. I mean, as I mentioned previously, right, of course, lawyers are just going to have to become really good at evaluating sources and figuring out how they fit. And not just, of course, like how to search, right? So there's that. How do they do that? Well, I can very easily see this changing the way that we educate lawyers, not just, of course, in law school, but in continuing legal education, right? Certain states require, including Pennsylvania, require specific legal education courses for attorneys on a yearly basis in ethics, for example, right? In Pennsylvania, I have to take a certain number of specific ethics classes per year. And a couple of states now are starting to require technology classes as well as, you know, ethics or whatever else. So in other words, out of the 12 hours or whatever it is you have to do of legal education classes per year, you now must do two or three technology courses. I see that proliferating, and I think that's going to just become a standard, because what we're really seeing here is technology changing every aspect of every kind of practice. And it's not, of course, limited to law. But this is a situation in which this sort of rather benign rule that says that you should try and make sure that your client isn't a scammer and that your witness doesn't have an obvious bias by using whatever resources are available to you to figure that out is suddenly really important and interesting and dangerous, because those resources just showed up on your phone and they're free and they're incredible. But they're not as simple as they look, right? It's going to change legal practice much in the same way that it's changing in every other industry, right? If you there's an old saying, I guess it's an old saying now, if you reach out to any of the anybody in the Fortune 500, regardless of what they make, right? They make cars or they make beer or whatever. They're going to tell you that they're a technology company first now, because technology has changed what they're doing so much that just understanding and being able to use the technology is a key part of their mission. And I think for lawyers, it's exactly the same thing, right? For every lawyer, no matter what law you practice, where you practice it, what your experience level is, understanding the technology that affects your practice is a critical skill that cannot possibly be understated. So, in other words, you know, we don't just have to close the technology gap. I think we need to completely eliminate it so that lawyers really are technologists. Because as I point out in the article, right, like this is just one way to search for information on the internet, right? And it's just really, we're only talking about a few different sources of information. Already somewhere in the world, someone is creating the next Google, like the next technology that will become ubiquitous. And there's no reason why lawyers aren't going to have to learn how to use that technology as well, proficiently, or else they're falling below a standard of providing good service to their clients.
Okay. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah. So one thing I want to do is recognize and thank the resources at Penn Law. The Biddle Library research staff was truly spectacular in helping me with research questions that were sometimes rather offbeat and bizarre, and they were unflappable and are a tremendous resource. So I just wanted to make sure that I thanked them using this platform.
That's great. And I have one final question for you before we sign off. What are you optimistic for in 2021?
I'm optimistic in 2021 that there will be some sort of return to normalcy, whatever that might mean to people. But what's really interesting is that I feel like as particularly as a society, we are learning how to function under extraordinary circumstances. We're figuring out different ways to do things, some of which might be a better way to do things. And so I'm excited to see how, as we are able to do things the old way, how we might continue to do things the new way, and how we might able to actually learn lessons from all the crises we've been having, and how to make things better, easier, more fulfilling, more inclusive, and basically how we might be able to take all of the lessons that we've been learning in the last year or so, and improve almost every aspect of what we do, and not just, of course, right, in our daily lives, in our houses, speaking to you from my home office in Spruce Hill, but also at the law school, at the university, and even beyond. So I'm optimistic about that in one sense. And then another sense, what I have seen out of the Penn Law student body over the last 7 months is nothing short of remarkable. And the resiliency, the positivity, the grit. And so as far as sort of the future of the legal profession, I am extremely optimistic about the profession, as long as the students that I've been working with are going to be a part of it.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us on Case in Point. And thank you, listeners, for listening to Case in Point.